History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, if only we will take the initiative to ask a few questions. And of course, employ the patience as stories from decades ago start filtering back to the surface. If we do all that, we're going to end up with awareness and perspective we might not be able to acquire any other way. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The man we have the privilege of visiting with today has spent more than half of his life in Modesto, California, where all his friends call him Gabe. Melvin Gablehouse grew up in Nebraska. He spent 20 years in the U.S. Navy, and he has the sailor tattoos to prove it. But the uniqueness of his story is that two of his most intense experiences, one in which his life was spared and another in which he risked his life to save others, both took place a little closer to American soil than you might expect. We're going to get to that, Gabe, but let's get started with the early years. What all do you remember about your childhood out in Lincoln, Nebraska?
Well, I guess it was a lot different than it would be today. Just school, chores. I guess that's about it in those days.
And I know you had a couple sisters. Were you the oldest of the three?
I was the oldest, yes.
So that means you probably got the best chores, right?
More or less, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what were those chores? I'm just thinking they might be different from what young people have to deal with today.
Yeah, well, working in the yard, pulling weeds and just taking care of things.
And you were growing up during the days of the Great Depression.
Right.
Do you have some memories of what that was like compared to, you know, what things are like now?
I compare that with a lot what's going on today with all these politics that's going on today, all the Hitler stuff in those days. You've heard a lot about that all the time, comparing it with what happened, some things today. We really didn't have radios at that time, and I used to build crystal sets for everybody. So we had crystal sets that get one station, maybe two, if he's lucky. Yeah.
Thinking about that, what would you be able to listen to on that crystal set? Were you picking up baseball games or just...
Oh, no, just news, mostly news, yeah. What's happening on the farmland and stuff like that.
And, you know, a lot of folks who I've talked to who lived through that time in the Great Depression, some say, hey, things were really tough and I saw my dad lose a job or we had to move. Others said, you know, I didn't really notice it at the time. Did you have an idea that times were hard, that people were struggling?
Oh, yeah, we knew times was rough. But we pretty much managed to have meals on the table every night. And my dad worked hard all the time, so it was a little easier for us than it was for a lot of them. And we lived in a neighborhood where everybody helped each other.
And since you say that, I'm wondering if maybe you have an example of that, because these days you don't hear so much of that. You hear a lot of people saying they're almost afraid of their neighborhoods or their neighborhoods. What were some ways that neighbors helped each other back then?
Oh, in almost every way. If there was a sickness or somebody needed help, or everybody just was different. Everybody helped each other. They talked of each other.
Do you remember as a boy having some ideas in your head of, hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do with my life? This is what I'm going to do or who I'm going to be?
Well, not until about 1939, I guess. We made a trip to California. I kind of sensed after that I just wanted to go in the Navy. That's what happened.
Where did you go in California, and what did you see that put that thought in your mind?
Well, we came to California, down around Fresno, down around the grape vineyard and stuff like that. And then from there, we went to Arizona. We had seen relatives in Arizona, yeah, and Merced. Had relatives in Merced, too. Yeah, it was great.
Was it just the climate or the landscape that was different from where you came from, or what was it that you think really got your attention?
Everything was different. Had bigger grocery stores and shopping centers, and everything else was different, yeah, from a small town, yeah, a lot different.
So 1939, you come to California, you get a taste of life out here, and you said it made you want to join the Navy. Did you see some ships somewhere?
Yeah, around San Diego or somewhere, I guess. I seen ships.
But then you went back to Nebraska and finished school?
Not long.
Yeah, because there's something we need to straighten out here, and I think the statute of limitations should be up by now. But when you enlisted in the Navy, you were only 16.
Right.
And you weren't supposed to be able to get in at 16. So how did you pull that off?
Well, my uncle and I went in at the same time. He was 17. I was 16. And I changed a birth certificate. The date on it from 1925. 1924, that kind of got it. As a matter of fact, we went to the recruiting office, and after the recruiting, one day we went back home after all this, went back home, and my mother said to me, she said, you know, that makes you older than your uncle. So we got back to the recruiting office the next day, and you know what the first question was? Who's the oldest? And I said, I am.
Well, I've had a lot of guys who've told me even when they wanted to go in at 17, their parents wouldn't sign for them. They wouldn't allow them to go. But your mother was in on this. She knew you were fudging that right. certificate?
Yep, she did. Yeah.
And had you finished high school yet or no?
Nope. Put my books into high school and they're still there.
What was the pull? Why was that such a motivation? Because this was before the U.S. is in World War II. This is 1941, before Pearl Harbor. And you're 16 years old, and you wanted to quit school and join the Navy. What was it that made you want to do that?
Instinct. Just something that was there. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew how long I wanted to study. Yeah.
You mean you knew you were going to put 20 years in at that point?
Yep, sure did. Yep.
Was there someone else you knew that had done that, or where'd that come from?
I knew one guy that went in the Navy and probably in maybe 37 or 38. I think I only seen him one time back home after that. Just instinct, wanted to do it.
All right, so you're 16, you quit high school, you join the Navy, and of course they're going to send you to boot camp then, right?
Right, we went to boot camp, and it was full, and they sent us back home. And they called us up later on, I guess maybe a couple of months later. Because I know when we got back, we had payday, $21 a month.
So if I'm doing the math right, you must have been back home in Nebraska when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Yes, that's right. That's true. Just declared war.
Because that was a Sunday morning when it happened, at least morning time out in Hawaii, a little later in Nebraska. Do you remember where you were or how you found out about it?
I was home in Lincoln. Yeah, declared war.
Did you hear that on your crystal set?
No. Word of mouth, I think.
Yeah, you said all you neighbors helped each other out, so maybe a neighbor came by and said?
Probably, yeah.
So did that mean you had to report again right away?
No, just waited until they got ready for us to go to boot camp. I don't know if that rushed up, but that probably did not because they didn't have room. At that time, the boot camp was all full.
So it wasn't until January that you got to go to boot camp?
Right, yeah, in the Great Lakes.
Big city.
Yeah. We went to the boot camp, and from there, graduated from boot camp and went to Naval Armory in Chicago, foot of Randolph Street in Chicago for gunnery training.
What kind of guns did you learn to use?
Old guns, they don't even have them anymore. They would call them 350s, and we worked with a lot of sidearms at that time, 50 calibers, 30 calibers, yeah.
Well, and I guess I should ask you, too, because we know what happened in hindsight now, but at the time, here you are, 16 years old when you signed up, still 16 when you head off to boot camp in early 1942. But now there's a war going on. Did that change your mind at all about your desire to serve?
Nope, just stayed right on in there. Graduated from gunnery school and was assigned to what they called armed guard. We were gunners, gunnery people. My first ship that I had after I left Chicago, went to Algiers, New Orleans, and checked in there, and a few days later caught a ship called the Samuel Q. Brown, was an oil tanker.
So that's a merchant ship that you're a Navy armed guard on.
2 days out, we got torpedoed.
2 days. You lasted a whole 2 days in the war before you got hit.
Yep.
So this is May 23rd, 1942. You're still 16 years old,
yep.
And your job is to defend this merchant ship. And so tell me about that day, May 23rd, 1942.
Early morning, boom, got torpedoed.
Where were you?
I was up on one of the decks next to the bridge. It was early morning, and I was asleep at the time. And I was one of the lucky ones that got to a lifeboat. A lot of people didn't, but I got to a lifeboat.
I know that's a long time ago, and we're talking almost 80 years ago now.
Right.
What woke you up?
The big bang. Yeah, and fire. Tanker. Yeah, oil.
This is an oil tanker. It gets hit by a torpedo. That's not a good result.
No. No way. Wow. No.
So it looks like the crew of that ship was 39 people with a complement of 16. I'd say, what was it like before you got torpedoed? But you're 2 days in, so you didn't probably even have a feel for how the ship operated yet.
We're out of the Mississippi River from muddy water into clean water 100 miles southeast of Cuba. And that's the way we got it.
So that was a German U-boat that got you?
Yeah, 103.
You know, there aren't too many people still with us who can say they got sunk by a German torpedo.
That ship was probably one of the first few ships that got torpedoed in World War II.
Were you aware that that was a possibility? Were you aware of the threat?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, yeah.
That's one of the reasons they want armed guards on the ship, right?
Right.
Okay, so it's early morning. You're asleep. The big bang and the fire, an oil tanker on fire, wakes you up. How did you get off the ship?
I was lower than a whaleboat. They call it whaleboats, yeah.
Do you know how many guys didn't make it?
Not exactly. There was some. I never did know how many. Some of the gun crew. I was in charge of a gun crew. And there were other merchant marine men that got killed, too, where that hit. Why? Towards the engine room of the people down there. They never got out.
So if you had been below deck instead of sleeping up top.
Good chance.
You wouldn't be here.
Wouldn't be here.
And there's kids and grandkids and great-grandkids and a soon-to-be great-great-grandkid who wouldn't be here.
Yeah, that's right.
And you weren't even 17. I just can't imagine what that must have felt like.
Well, you're young. You don't realize it. You just don't think about it, you know?
I know this is going to sound like a weird question, but it comes to mind because of some of the Merchant Marine veterans who I've interviewed who were in similar situations where their ships got hit. And they didn't, at the time, receive any veterans' benefits. And some of them still haven't received Purple Hearts, even though they were wounded. And you just kind of highlighted in your situation, you're a Navy armed guard on the ship.
Yeah.
There are merchant marine gunners doing a very similar job as you,
right,
who were killed. What's your opinion on that? Should they have been given the same medals and honors as someone in the Navy?
Sure, they should. Sure, yeah, definitely.
And I'm guessing probably you hadn't really gotten to know anybody all too well on that ship yet, huh?
No. Nobody, really, at that time yet, no. Just getting settled.
Again, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. That happens 2 days into your Navy deployment. How did that affect your outlook or your perspective after that?
No bearing on it. Just kept going. More ships. She kept shipping out.
And when they lowered you to the whale boat, was there concern that even then you guys were still in danger?
Oh, sure. As a matter of fact, the submarine service talked to us. The crew came out and talked to us. They questioned the captain that was there, and somebody asked him for cigarettes from the crew, and they wouldn't give him no cigarettes. Told him to talk to the president. And they just gave us instructions. They just said, you're 100 miles southeast of Cuba, and that's the direction.
Were you wondering if you might be taken prisoner in that circumstance?
Afraid of getting shot. You know, the Japanese submarines, when they did that, they shot a lot of people.
Yeah.
But they were friendly.
So these Germans just wanted to sink your ship and then hang out with you.
Right. That's what they did. Yeah. They surfaced.
Well, and I guess I should ask, too, since your last name is Gablehaus, is that a German name?
German name. Uh-huh. Yeah, but they don't know that.
And they were speaking English to your captain?
Yeah. Yep.
I don't think most 16-year-olds have a day like that.
I don't think so. No. But I imagine it was probably people that are younger than I was. I imagine. I don't know.
So what happened next? They put you on that whale boat. Then what?
A destroyer came out and picked us up and took us to Cuba. And then from Cuba, we was put aboard ship and taken back to the States.
And again, I don't want to move on too quickly from this because it's such a unique circumstance that most of us will never live through. So as you're kind of floating away, or even as you're talking to the German submarine, as they're talking to your captain, can you still see the ship or is it already gone?
No, it's still there. It's still afloat.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So it must be smoking pretty good.
It's burning.
Yeah?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the destroyer that came up finally sunk it. They threw some rounds into it and sunk it.
So you're 16 years old, and right there, May 23rd, 1942, you're confronted with the reality that in war, people die.
Yeah, true.
Did you think about the possibility that you could be killed?
Oh, yeah. When we seen that thing surface, that's what we figured they was going to do, but they didn't.
So here your mother had signed for you, gone along with you faking your birth certificate. Did you tell her about your ship getting sunk?
Oh, yeah. We came home, and when I got home, emergency leave, came back home. We had interviews from the paper and everything like that. So they all knew. That was in the right up in the Lincoln Journal, I guess it was.
Well, since it's time for a commercial break, and we know the power of the internet can help us track down articles like that, let's see if we can pull it up when we return. 96-year-old Gabe Gablehouse of Modesto, California is our guest today, a 20-year veteran of the U.S. Navy. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of him as a 16-year-old sailor, and also what he looks like now, of course, and we'll be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 96-year-old Melvin Gablehouse of Modesto, California. Gabe, as he's known to the neighbors and friends who continue to enjoy his baking talents. More on that later. But when we left off, he had told us about his experience as part of a Navy Armed Guard contingent on the merchant ship SS Samuel Q. Brown. That ship left New Orleans with 80,000 barrels of Navy No. 6 fuel oil. 2 days later, while passing through the Yucatan Channel, it was spotted by a German submarine, U-103, which stalked it for a couple of hours before firing two torpedoes, which both missed. A second attempt hours later, though, is what woke up 16-year-old Gabe Gablehouse. The explosion from the torpedo killed two men instantly and set the ship on fire. And Gabe mentioned being interviewed by the Lincoln Journal Star while home on leave in Nebraska right after that ordeal. That article is accessible online. It's from June 11th, 1942, and under the headline, Lincoln Sailor Sorry to See His Merchant Vessel Sink, it reads, his ship, an oil tanker out of New Orleans, was torpedoed amidships on Saturday night, May 23rd, while Melvin was asleep forward on the second deck. The torpedo tore off the first deck all the way across on top, he said. It took just 20 seconds for 48 men aboard the ship to lower into two undamaged lifeboats and get clear of the ship, according to Melvin. Three sailors were killed in the attack. One fell victim of a shark after he jumped. Three others were burned badly by flaming oil and are now in the hospital. The men in the boats were questioned by members of the sub crew, quote, who spoke better English than I do, Melvin said. They asked a lot of questions, but all they could get out of us was the name of the ship, which was hard for the commander to understand. Quite the experience there for a 16-year-old. So how did you feel about going back aboard a ship after that?
No problem. Went right back out and caught another ship. As a matter of fact, we came back home on the Yarmouth. Brought us back to New Orleans. Gave us 30 days leave. Went home, come back, right back out on another ship.
So I guess you got to celebrate your 17th birthday on your next ship, or can you not celebrate a 17th birthday when you're supposed to be older than that?
I don't remember birthdays. No, no.
And what kind of ship were you on next?
My next ship out, we hauled sulfur, okay. Stinking stuff. And we picked that up and brought it back. I got off of that ship. I went on to another ship. We went up all the way up the Amazon River, almost as far as you could go, and picked up a load of, they call them Chitoya nuts. I don't know what the hell that is, but that's what it was. And after that, was on a ship called Abraham Baldwin, On that one, we went around the Straits, San Antonio, Chile.
So you went all the way down to the southern tip of South America.
Yeah.
And, not to interrupt, but you said you went almost all the way down the Amazon River.
Yeah.
I haven't met too many Navy guys who got to do that.
No.
Of course, this is a merchant ship still.
Right. Yeah.
What kind of stuff did you see on that Amazon cruise there?
Just river and trees and shacks. That was it all the way up. People come out and wave at you once in a while when they see you.
No piranhas?
No piranhas. I'm sure they were there. But our business was to go up and pick it up and get out.
So if I'm counting right, the Abraham Baldwin, by that time you've already been on four different ships as an armed guard, and now you go all the way down around the tip of South America to come back around. You're kind of seeing a lot of the world as a young man, aren't you?
Even ended up in Tahiti on that ship, and we had a burial at sea on that ship.
What happened?
Some guy died.
Not enemy action or anything?
No, just burial at sea. And after that, I got out of there altogether. I really wanted a Navy ship, but I went to outfit called Acorn 28, and then we went from there to Port Hueneme, which is in California, which was nothing there at that time, but tents. We lived in tents. And from there, we caught a ship and went to the Admiralty Islands out in the South Pacific. That's where I finished the war out there.
Well, a couple of things come to mind here. When you say, you wanted something different altogether, you wanted a Navy ship. Were you starting to realize that being an armed guard on a merchant ship wasn't that safe, or did it have to do with...
What
was it?
No, I just wanted to get back in the fleet. You had reserve, yep, Navy and the regular Navy.
Uh-huh.
I was regular Navy, and I wanted to get in with the fleet, to catch a destroyer or a cruiser or something like that where I could bed down and stay for a long time.
And I'm curious what it was like on those merchant ships, because you have merchant seamen and then you have... these Navy sailors. Did you guys get along okay?
Oh, yeah. Ain't good?
Yeah.
Good job, yeah. Oh, yeah. All good.
So you wanted to get into the fleet, and they put you in Acorn 28. Now, some people might not know what an Acorn unit is. Explain that to us.
It's a outfit that during the war went overseas in islands. They had islands all over out in the South Pacific. What we would do out there is when the planes from the carriers would go fight and get shot up, they wouldn't go back to the carrier. They would land on the island, and we'd fix the planes, patch them, fix them back up, send them back to the carrier. That's what that was all about.
So you guys were a Navy flyer's best friend?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fix them up and send them back.
So you practiced that a little bit at Port Hueneme?
Not that part of it, no. What you've practiced there was, just a little bit of everything. Motor pools where they kept all the heavy equipment. The boat pool where they had the boats.
And then you said you got sent to the Admiralty Islands. So, again, a lot of people listening say, okay, Admiralty Islands. I don't know where that is. Tell us.
Out in the South Pacific, yeah. There's maybe four islands. A main island, which was Manus Island. And I was on island called Petilu. Then there was about two or three more islands that I don't even remember that they manned the same way. Yeah, the British took that over. And all we did was... when they cleaned up, built an airstrip, dug a well, put out a bunch of pots over the ocean, over the bay, and called it home.
That's what I want to understand. That had to be a pretty unique place to spend the rest of the war. How long total do you think you were there?
I think I went over there in maybe the latter part of 43 and stayed until the war ended in 45. As a matter of fact, where I was at on the Admiralty Islands, when the war was about to come to an end, more or less, all the ships of the fleet came to the Admiralty Islands and was getting ready to invade Japan. And that's when they dropped the bomb.
But you've been there a while before that. And as, again, I try to imagine what this must be like. So you and the rest of these guys in Acorn 28, you're kind of making something out of nothing. How many people do you think you had in that unit?
Probably 200 or 300 people. You had mechanics and a lot of aviation people, and boat pool people, motor pool people, communications people.
And you had to pretty much build anything you wanted to use?
It had to be built. Quonset huts, yeah. We all carried rifles all the time. And we had an airplane to come over every morning. Some gal in there, Tokyo Road, over the loudspeaker every morning, said, "We know you're down there. We know what you're doing." Yeah, yeah.
How did you feel about that?
Pay no attention to her. could have shot. We weren't allowed to.
That sounds like an awfully interesting way for a teenager to live.
Yeah.
What were some of the pros and cons?
Well, let's see. For the time, everything was pretty good. You know, everything was rationed to you, but you had everything except, you know, your dental and stuff like that was terrible. You needed dental work, and it wasn't no teeth filling; it was pull.
With no anesthesia?
Oh, you had anesthesia, yeah. And working my teeth in school with no anesthesia, though.
I was going to say, yeah, it sounds like that's something you experienced personally. You had to have some teeth pulled there?
Yeah, I had a problem with my teeth quite a bit, yeah.
Did you get to get out and explore much of that island?
Oh, yeah. We'll go around it every day. Only one a mile long, a half mile wide, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had things happening every day. It was a big bay that had a lot of ships in there every day. And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you about a ship that came in there one morning. Was it in the morning that ship came in? USS Mount Hood was an ammunition ship. It came into the bay to keep them in a different area. They pulled in there and they anchored and they lowered the boats and the boats pulled away from the ship. They would go over to the Bannis Island to pick up mail and stuff like that. The ship was there 1 minute, next minute it was gone. Blew up.
And you were there to see that?
I was out of the dock. I watched it happen. I just said, hey, a ship came in last night. I looked over there. Gone.
That had to be quite a loud boom.
Yeah, that was terrible.
You could probably feel that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, sure you could.
And was that a situation where there's not a whole lot you can do to help anybody?
Nothing. The only people who made it off there was the guys that went to get the mail. LCMs lowered, and it was not a pretty picture.
Yeah, and I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm just imagining, again, still being a teenager. Yeah. And that's hard to witness.
Yeah, well, you grow up in a hurry.
And anyone who has ever seen a photograph of that USS Mount Hood explosion knows how devastating this was. I'll post one of those photos at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. 350 men were vaporized in an instant, and 22 smaller craft in the area were sunk, destroyed, or sustained so much damage they couldn't be repaired. Another 371 sailors from other ships in the harbor were hurt. It was a devastating tragedy on November 10th, 1944, that would be blamed basically on careless handling of ammunition. Let's talk about something more pleasant, Gabe. I saw a photo that you have from there in the Admiralty Islands of some pretty famous entertainers that came through. It sure looked like Frances Langford, who I'm sure was singing I'm in the Mood for Love, and that guy next to her in the photo is perhaps the most famous of all the USO performers during World War II.
Bob Hope.
Well, and Bob Hope entertained so many troops in so many places in the war. Can you help us understand what that meant to you guys to have someone like him show up and put on that show?
Oh, sure. It was entertaining, and, you know, it took your mind off a lot of things, you know. Yeah. He did a good show.
And I see you have a photo of some pretty good-sized fish you caught when you were living there on the Admiralty Islands.
Yes. Barracuda. A lot of all hand-lining. Put bait on it and throw it out. Used to do a lot of that after work.
Where would you catch them?
Right off the pier. The barracuda would chase in the bait to the pier and take a hand grenade and drop it down in there and get the bait.
Hand grenade fishing.
Hand grenade fishing, yeah.
I don't think I've never tried that myself, certainly. Well, what did the barracuda taste like?
Very good meat. It's good meat. Barracuda is good meat. All white, like sturgeon.
Okay, so you're part of Acorn 28, but what was your specific job within that? What did you get to do?
I was in the motor pool for quite a while, and then I transferred from the motor pool to the boat pool, run a boat down. I had a boat, what they call a rearming boat. I would run people around the different boats, different ships and stuff like that. A lot of the captains and stuff off the ships, they'd go to different ships and have parties and stuff like that. I would run them.
So you were kind of the chauffeur for the big brass?
More or less, yeah. Yeah, rather. Yeah, you call it that.
I'm just thinking you might have had some memorable interactions in those instances.
Yeah, no, just do your job.
And you mentioned earlier the significance of having a place where some of these planes off the carriers could land, get fixed up. Did you ever get a sense for how important that was, how significant that was in the bigger picture?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They couldn't go back to the ship, so they had to be prepared somewhere enough to get back to the ship and then go out and do what they're supposed to do. Do their bombing, and whatever they had to do. Bring the war to an end, yeah.
And was that pretty much a constant stream of those guys?
Yeah, every day. Yeah, every day. they go out and get shot up.
And you got to see some of those?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah.
I guess that makes me wonder, when you see every day there's a shot up plane coming in, yeah, and these guys are all out there, and you know those are the lucky ones,
right,
who didn't go in the drink.
Yeah.
What kind of impression you were left with of who those guys were and what they were all about?
They were doing their job, doing what they're supposed to do.
And how about the weather? Because they have typhoons in the South Pacific.
Yeah, they had bad weather sometimes. It was hot all the time. Didn't bother you. Get used to it.
Did you ever hear from home?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we all, yeah. Everything was censored. All the letters censored. Couldn't tell where he was at.
And you were there when news came that the bombs had been dropped,
right, yeah,
and that the war was over?
Sure, yeah.
What do you remember about those moments where that's some pretty big news coming to where you are?
Yeah, just to get ready to go home. All regular Navy. Just get ready, you're going to go home. That's what we did. Came in here to California to Camp Shoemaker.
Did you have a decision to make as far as staying in or getting out?
You know, the question was always asked, you know, what are you going to do? Well, I knew what I was going to do.
Which was stay in the Navy for 20 years. And there were many more adventures to come for Gabe Gablehouse. It's the Navy's fault he met his wife. We'll hear how that happened. And also what he did that caused the Secretary of the Navy to issue a commendation. Two lives were saved as a result. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Mr. Gablehouse, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 96-year-old Gabe Gablehouse of Modesto, California, originally from Lincoln, Nebraska, where he fudged his birth year from 1925 to 24 so he could join the Navy at age 16. His first ship was sunk from underneath him by a German torpedo in the Atlantic, but he'd spend most of World War II in the South Pacific with Acorn 28 in the Admiralty Islands. That's where he witnessed the tragic explosion of the ammunition ship USS Mount Hood. Let's pick up Gabe's story story after VJ Day when he returned to the States, ending up at Camp Shoemaker in California's Bay Area.
I went from there to Virginia. I went aboard the USS Mississippi. It was a battleship, but it was a converted to a gunnery ship. And we'd go out every day and practice gunnery. From the Mississippi to the USS Ranger, the old Ranger, which is CB-4, and it did the same thing.
This must have been the time period when you met your wife.
Right.
And it sounds like if it weren't for the Navy, you wouldn't have met your wife.
No, that's true.
So what happened? How'd you guys meet?
I seen her go into a department store. She went into that store, and I seen her go in there. I was with my friend. She went up in the elevator, and I finally went up, starting to looking, and I found she worked there. She worked in the photo department, tinning of photos. That's where I met her right there.
What was her name?
Her name was Mary O'Dell.
What was it about her that made an impression on you?
Just a good-looking gal, nice lady.
How did she feel about sailors?
Hey, none of them felt too good about sailors, I don't think. Not at first, anyhow, yeah.
You had to win her over?
I won her over, yeah. Yeah, we married January 28th, 1949, and she died January 28th, 2003.
Exactly 54 years of marriage.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Then we moved to California, and that's when I ended up on the destroyer escort, Gilligan. I was on there for about 2 years, I guess.
Yeah.
And then I went from there to Treasure Island for 2 years. And I went from Treasure Island to the USS General A.E. Anderson with a troop transport. And we carried troops to, well, all over the world, mostly to South Korea. We carried pilots. Whatever we took in, we had to bring that many back out.
I want to ask you about something that happened during the Korean War, because I was able to find a little write-up about you from 1951. We think about the Navy or the Army, and we think about combat, but there are a lot of other things that are happening. So this is what this says about you. Under the headline, honored for rescuing two injured shipmates. It says, for rescuing two shipmates who had been injured by huge waves which were about to sweep them overboard from their ship, Melvin M. Gablehouse, BM-1, USN, has been awarded a Secretary of the Navy letter of commendation. When USS Gilligan, DE-508, was entering the channel leading into Coos Bay Harbor, Oregon, its stern was engulfed by a huge wave. Two men were knocked down and injured and were about to be swept overboard by a second giant wave when Gablehouse went to their rescue. He assisted them to a place of safety just before the second wave engulfed the stern of the ship, thus saving the men from probable death.
Yeah.
All right, so I got to hear this story. So I'm assuming your wife's probably back home in California, right?
She's in Portland.
So this sounds pretty routine, right? You're just going up to Coos Bay, training guys how to fire the guns.
Yeah. Right. Well, we went into Coos Bay, everything was fine. We was coming into Coos Bay, a wave give out, and we dropped, I think, about 33 feet or something. Then the wave came over the top of the ship. The gun turrets, they're built up like that, they just flattened them. Took water down the stack, just a freak accident.
And where were you at the time?
I was out on the stern of the deck, on the back,
and
holding on.
I was going to say, I mean, it's not like you're standing on level ground. This, you're getting jolted.
Yeah, yeah. I had my hands through a bar and locked, trying to hold on.
Well, and that's what strikes me about that story when I read it. I'm thinking, what would I do? And if there's a wave that big that could maybe even, you know, take the ship down, right?
Yeah.
That I would be holding on for dear life.
If you see it coming, I see it coming. Yeah, if anybody didn't see it coming, why, they're gone.
So you're holding on for dear life, and while you're doing that, you notice these two other guys?
They got washed into the hand lines, you call them. Uh-huh. Yeah, we got them back. And then I picked up, it was a great big old piece of a gangplank, more or less, and I threw it over the side because I could see sailors out in the water.
Well, and how far were you from these guys you saved?
Probably 15, 20 feet, maybe a little closer.
And so it says, two men were knocked down and injured and were about to be swept overboard by a second wave when you came to the... So you didn't have a lot of time here.
No.
And weren't you risking your own life by letting go and going to them?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
So what makes somebody do that?
Instinct, I guess. I don't know.
And so you threw something to them, or you had to go get to where they were?
I went to where they were, but the other guys was already in the water when I threw this out, so they could float on it if they could get to it. I don't think some of them made it.
So let's talk about these two guys. They're 15 to 20 feet away from you?
I was maybe closer. Okay. Maybe closer, yeah. The gun tub was here, and then the side of the ship. Yeah, maybe a little closer, probably maybe 10, 12 feet probably.
But you can tell they didn't see this coming. They get knocked down, and they're hurt?
Yeah, they got washed into the lines from somewhere. I don't remember where they were.
So what would have happened to them if you didn't act?
On that next wave, we'll just push them through the lines. They would have been out in the water, in the river.
So you run to them, and you help them both. Where'd you pull them to?
Where I was at, uh-huh. On the line, on the gun tub.
And I'm just trying to imagine this scene in my head, and it kind of feels like it's one of those movies where as you're watching, it goes in slow motion, and you don't know if you're going to get them back there in time.
You don't know.
Because if you've let go and you're with them and you're trying to get back in time and that wave hits too soon, you're going to get washed away with them.
Yeah, all of it. Yeah.
How close do you think it was?
I have no idea.
You think like a second or two?
Probably. It was quick, yeah. But probably within a couple of seconds.
And so when that wave did hit, what was that like?
That's when it did all the damage. As much damage. More so than the first one, I think.
And you're feeling that wave, I'm sure.
Well, where I was and where we were at that time, not so much because it broke up from the gun tub, where we were at.
So you had some shelter.
Hanging on.
I imagine they were appreciative of your efforts.
I don't even know who they were.
You think they knew who you were?
Probably not. Like I said, it was a lot of reservists on there, and you don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. They come from all over.
It's not impossible that one of them could be listening right now.
Never know. Never know.
But it wasn't over yet, so you get them to safety, and that commendation says you saved their lives. But then you notice there's people that are in the river?
Yeah. Yeah, you can see heads bobbing. Yeah. I don't remember if they lowered boats to go get those people. No, I don't even remember.
You ripped up a piece of the gangplank, or you saw it lying on the side?
No, it was just laying there. Okay. It was, I forget what it was. Well, I don't remember why it was there.
I wonder if the wave knocked it loose or something.
I don't know. I didn't know it was there.
So you picked that up and threw it in the water.
I do.
Here's another. I know these are a lot of questions about one particular thing, but I'm just fascinated because I wonder how many people listening would have done what you did. And I'm wondering, were there other people nearby who, you were the only one?
Only one I know was out there at that time. Yeah. So, in that particular spot.
So if you didn't help them, nobody would?
There was nobody there to do it, no. We was all in stations, regular stations for entering port.
Is that something that when you see your wife again back in Portland, you tell her about, or you say, maybe I shouldn't tell her?
No, they all knew about it. It was all in the paper. Yeah. Some of the families drove up to Coos Bay from Portland. And that's a hell of a drive.
You mean the families of the guys you saved?
Yeah. No, all the shipboard people.
All right. So this is during the Korean War, and you're doing that there. And then you said you got on a troop ship and took pilots to Korea, right?
Troops and pilots, yeah. Carried a lot of troops. We would load up in San Francisco, Fort Mason, go to Oakland, fill up with stores, and then head out to, first stop was usually Hawaii, and then Japan, and then one cruise would be same thing, except not Japan, we go to Korea, all over, dropping troops off.
Do you ever spend time thinking about what those troops you're carrying would be experiencing over there?
No, you do. You just about knew what was going on.
And you still weren't done because you told us you stayed in till 1961. So what were you doing those last several years in the Navy?
Well, let's see. I was stationed once in Atsugi Bay. Atsugi, Japan. I was in there when the pilot flew a U-2 plane, Powers, when he was flying that. He landed every night, well, almost every night, at Atsugi. The Marines would go out and hold the wings up on the plane because it only had two wheels.
So, and I just to put this in context, and people, if they're not familiar with the story, I'm sure they can Google Francis Gary Powers and they'll get the whole story about the U-2 spy plane.
Yeah.
But at the time, this isn't supposed to be known. This is top secret, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you knew about it.
I could go out on the field. Where he was landing, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you knew what the purpose was?
Oh, yeah, spy plane, yeah, oh, we all knew.
So you had a secret that you had to keep?
Well, who was he going to tell? You know, he'd tell nobody, yeah, yeah. Well, he would come in there almost every night, making those flights. He'd go out and watch Gary come in.
Yeah, did you ever talk to him or anything?
No, no, he was surrounded by Marines and everything else. They get him out and take him somewhere.
Well, I imagine then that when what happened to him happened, when he disappeared, that's probably something that got your attention.
Not really.
No.
You know, you just figure those kind of things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you joined in 41. You got out in 61. Was there any part of you that was hoping you could stay in the Navy longer?
No. I was married and had three kids.
Yeah.
And I figured it was time.
What was your favorite thing about 20 years in the Navy?
I loved it all. Had a good time. I enjoyed it.
And I don't know if I asked you before when we were talking about World War II or any of these other times. Was there something that when you look back, you say, hey, that was the most challenging thing I had to go through?
No, not really. It's all a challenge. All, every day is a challenge of the service.
Well, what do you think enabled you to meet that challenge? Was there something from a mental or psychological standpoint, or just the way you were raised that you think helped you?
Yeah, probably the way I was raised. It was just something that I wanted. Just something I wanted to do.
Well, one thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it. When you look back on that, 20 years serving in the Navy, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Yeah, just serving. Yeah, enjoyed it.
Are there some moments that you lived through during your time in the Navy that sometimes still pop back in your mind, you can see them visually?
Yeah. It's torpedoing, I see that once in a while. Out in the Admiralty Islands, I see that once in a while. But nothing real bad.
And you're 96 now?
Mm-hmm. It's 96 July 24th.
So what keeps you going?
You got me. The good man up there, I guess.
I think when I walked in the door, I felt a little ashamed because you were standing straighter than I was. What's your secret to staying in such good shape?
I used to walk and work out a little bit, but I don't do that no more. Other than that, I do a lot of baking.
What do you bake?
Everything. Bread, cookies, cakes, anything you need. Give it all away.
How long you been doing that?
Oh, years. Yeah, a long time.
So you're 96 years old and you're still baking to give it away to your neighbors.
Yeah. I took, I guess, about 3 or 4 dozen cookies yesterday to the doctor's office. Turned the ladies loose on the cookies. They enjoyed it.
I have to imagine they would. And I guess I have to ask the obvious question. Why? Why do you do that?
I like to do it. It keeps me going. No aches or pains when you're doing it.
I guess I also have to ask, what's the tastiest thing you've ever baked?
Well, the thing that I enjoy is you wouldn't know what it is. It's an old German. They used to call them Grauhoge, or Grauhoge from the Lake of Nebraska. The old German people used to make it. It's cabbage and hamburger and onions, filling, and you put it in a piece of dough and you bake it. It's a hell of a meal.
It almost sounds like a bigger version of a beer rock.
Well, it is, yeah, beer rock. Beer rock, I think, is made with sausage, and Grauhoge is made with hamburger.
And is there anything that you haven't done yet in 96 years that you're still hoping to do sometime?
I don't know. Maybe I'll parachute out of a plane one of these days.
Have you ever done that?
No.
But you want to.
Looks like it might be a challenge.
Well, maybe that'll be the next chapter in a pretty fascinating life story. That is Gabe Gablehouse, 96 years old. Check out the photos and that short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.